Okay, this is January 24th, 1990. Interview of Dr. Walter Heusermann by Michael Neufeld in Huntsville, Alabama. And so first, Dr. Heusermann, I'd just like to ask you to state your full name, your birthplace, birth date, so forth.
I'm Walter Heusermann, in German Heusermann. And I was born the 2nd of March, 1914.
And what was your birthplace?
My birthplace was Künzelsau.
How would you spell that?
Württemberg, K-U-E, or umlaut instead of U-E, N-Z-E-L-S-A-U.
And that is where in Württemberg?
That is in the northern part of today Baden-Württemberg. About, since you mentioned before, Nuremberg, it is only about 60 kilometers from Nuremberg.
Oh, really?
Actually, west of Nuremberg.
Is it in the area of Rotenburg or
yes.
up there?
Yes.
So you come from
right.
near Rotenburg, huh?
Right. I went to school in Schwäbisch Hall.
It's certainly a name that I know. I've unfortunately never had a chance to go there. I hear it's
beautiful.
Very beautiful
place.
Your father's occupation was?
My father was a merchant. Actually, he had his own big hardware store.
And he made
agricultural machinery.
Agricultural machinery and so forth. And he stayed with that pretty much throughout your career, at least
right.
up to the Second World War when
That's
everything
right.
was disrupted. Huh? And so you went to school in Schwäbisch Hall, and you go to a gymnasium or Real Gymnasium.
It was the Oberrealschule in Schwäbisch Hall.
And would you say your inclination was technical or scientific?
I was always best in mathematics and physics. And I volunteered usually to also in chemistry, and I usually volunteered to set up the equipment for my teachers in physics and in chemistry.
So when you went to university, you pretty much had predetermined that you'd wanted to be an engineer or a scientist?
I first thought I should become a physicist, but then as it is requested in Germany, you have to go through a kind of abbreviated apprenticeship before you enter an institute of technology. So I got this practicum, as we called it, in right afterwards for 1.5 years at the Robert Bosch company. And that gave me then the idea I better go into engineering than into physics. I wanted to be closer to the hardware.
You were going to, had you planned which Technische Hochschule that you wanted to go to?
I went first in 1933 to the Technische Hochschule in Stuttgart. And after I received the full diplom, which is equal to the bachelor degree, or bachelor in engineering, I went then because I preferred the level of the Institute of Technology in Darmstadt. So I went at that time to Darmstadt in 1935. Where I stayed to get my master's degree in electrical engineering. And even before I got this, I had the excellent chance to become an assistant professor on the Institute of Electrical Machinery. And then after I had received my master's degree, I stayed there in order to write my thesis. However, the war came in between, and it was not possible to continue on my thesis, which required a lot of build-up of electrical machinery. So I could not continue on this.
Okay, let me get some details from that. You first went to Stuttgart in 1933?
That's right.
Your microphone.
No, it's just been
So you first went, I was wondering, had you determined that you definitely wanted to go to a Technische Hochschule, because of course one could also do physics on the, in the university
I had made up my mind by that time already, after I had the practical experience from Robert Bosch, that I wanted to become an engineer, and I wanted to go into the engineering field. For that reason, I went to the Institute of Technology in Darmstadt, in Stuttgart first.
In Stuttgart, and you'd pretty clearly focused on electrical engineering,
yes,
right from the beginning. Huh?
Now, you have to understand, at that time, the first four semesters were almost equal whether you studied mechanical engineering or electrical engineering. There was a little bit more emphasis on electrical engineering. And this, to go specifically into electrical engineering, almost still equal to electronic engineering, was then in the later semesters.
So that initial 2 years is pretty much transferable other places. And from, so at Darmstadt, you started in 35 and became a diploma engineer in 37 in 2 years?
I, at that time, had a practical, or had to work on quite some practical equipment, actually, especially built machinery, it was delayed. And since I was at the same time already an assistant professor, I got my, actually my, my thesis or my work I wrote up a little delayed, and so I got my degree in March
38. So you were already an assistant
yes,
before that time, right, which was, of course, a good position. What was your field then, and who was your advisors or
At that time, I was at the Lehrstuhl für Elektromaschinenbau, that means electrical machinery, and my professor was Professor Franklin Punga.
How was the last name spelled?
P-U-N-G-A.
Mm-hmm. So
he was very famous in this field.
You considered Darmstadt a superior institution to Stuttgart?
At that time, yes.
Where would it rank in among all the Technische Hochschulen, or is such a ranking possible?
At that time, I considered Darmstadt and Berlin equivalent as the very best.
And you were working in heavy current electrical generation and that kind of thing, or what were you working in?
Yes,
your area?
This is correct. But as a hobby, I had taken on also control of electrical machinery, like voltage control, frequency control, and so on. This was the only way to go into the field of control. So at that time, I had, as much as it was possible, already specified to go into this area.
Which would have brought you then into contact with the electronics at the same time,
right,
basic vacuum
exactly.
tube electronics.
Right. Yes,
To some extent, was that, and that was unusual for someone involved on the heavy current side.
Not necessarily,
power
because
side.
There was obvious that there is a need for precision control in the future. And a specific problem was the synchronization of large networks.
Okay. So you started as an assistant in 37 or so.
Correct.
When you're finishing, in the same field? The same person?
I could not finish in that field because when in 39 the war broke out, I was drafted. Into the army, and by that time, my professor learned that there is a demand for engineers, and he recommended, or he gave my name to the people in Peenemünde. Thus, I was pulled out of the army even before I left Germany for any war activities. I was pulled out and started with my work as a civilian in 39, actually 1st of December 39 in Peenemünde.
So was that person, was that Punga again?
Punga had recommended me for this. But then I, in Peenemünde, I worked under Dr. Steinhoff.
That's because I'm interested in, I know that of all the Technische Hochschule, and Darmstadt has the largest role in Peyneman's research.
The explanation for this, you might have heard this before, is because Dr. Steinhoff and others in Peenemünde had excellent relations to the Technische Hochschule in Darmstadt, and Dr. Steinhoff requested, therefore, if there are people who can be recommended for working in Peenemünde, he wanted to have the names from the professors in Darmstadt.
I've talked to who else from Darmstadt? I'm trying to remember now.
Dr. Holzer.
Holzer, yes. Talked to him. I talked to him how he came into the business. Fortunately, as I said, I haven't got his transcript from the
interview. There are many. Did you talk to Mr. Holberg?
No, not yet. But I certainly saw from what they were describing that it had developed not so much because it doesn't seem anyway that Darmstadt was or Dresden, which probably had the second largest role, was picked out for a particular reason so much as it was a kind of network. That is, people went back to their original Dr. Vaters or supervisors and so forth and said, who have you got or can you help me? You think then, obviously, of course, Darmstadt, if is one of the best, that might also be a factor. But it was largely a sort of network started because Steinhoff went to, at least in the electronics and guidance and control. This didn't come about because of the assignment of particular research projects to Darmstadt after September 39.
This happened afterwards. So many people from Darmstadt started to work in Peenemünde when they knew, again, who is the best place to do research work. And that's why contracts were given then to Darmstadt.
I know there's that so-called Tag der Weisheit in September 39. This is where they first started bringing people in large numbers into Peenemünde from the universities. See, I guess I was under the false impression that you had been involved in you had come from that side, that you had been at the university and been brought into, but actually you were assigned to Peenemünde itself and were an employee of Peenemünde.
Well, to use, I don't know the perfect English translation for this, I was Dienstverpflichtet.
Yeah.
You know this term? And as such, I was paid by Peenemünde, but had immediately the right after the end of the war to return to Darmstadt into my former position.
So, technically, you were kind of on loan from the university and on loan from the army also. So you never you were just in basic training or something, and then almost immediately assigned what was called BSM, right? Into the Electronics and Guidance Laboratory. When you went, you had no previous knowledge of Peenemünde's existence, or
no, nothing. It was a completely new situation for me.
Did you have any knowledge of, or had paid any attention to, the rocket?
From a hobby viewpoint, yes, very much so. But I had no idea about the progress that had been made in the meantime, and I was astonished about what I saw then in Peenemünde.
From the hobby standpoint, would you say, what do you mean? What did you observe in the late 20s?
I read, of course, whatever was available in this field, like the work of Valier and others.
Yeah, because I've written an article about that period in the late 20s where I tried to look at how it fit into Weimar. The Weimar Republic, but you just would say that it was a fascination as a teenage boy with Obert and with the. Did you see Frauen Mond?
No,
at that time?
No, I didn't.
You didn't see the movie, so it was. But in effect, it was accidental then.
That's right.
You were assigned to Peenemünde.
Right.
I suppose
just on recommendation of my professor.
There would have been a considerable gap, probably, because in the space flight and rocket thing, because you wouldn't have heard much about it, right? During the Third Reich, there wasn't much said.
On the other side, don't forget, our education was very broad.
Mm-hmm.
I had excellent lectures received in the field of child dynamics, as far as at that time you could get.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever was available at that time was not basically new to me.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, there was not much known, and we had to start from scratch in many areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I'm actually asking you here is not the technical side, which I want to get to, but you probably hadn't thought much about space flight or rocketry since the late 20s, right?
I didn't think that it was so close at that time.
Yeah. It had disappeared as an issue in many ways. Under the Third Reich, it sort of gone down and disappeared out of the media. Okay, so you came in 1939, and you had not known Steinhoff beforehand?
No.
He had been in another institute or something, at Darmstadt.
Yeah, correct.
And you arrived in... I try to remember. Did you say December the 1st?
1st of December.
1st of December, 1939. What was your first impression of the place, of the organization of Steinhoff and so forth?
Well, I was at the beginning told we don't even have yet a laboratory where you can make experiments, where you should get familiar with the control components.
Mm-hmm.
So I was told the best is you get an assignment from us to go to one of our companies. And this was the Geiselgeräte in Berlin-Zehlendorf.
Mm-hmm.
And I was assigned to Berlin-Zehlendorf for 3 months, till Easter 1940, just to get familiar what Geiselgeräte had been doing at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And the intent was that afterwards I go in the same way to Siemens Halske.
Mm-hmm.
However, since there was some pressure to continue with the building up of the laboratory in Peenemünde, I had been only for about a little over a week then afterwards in Siemens Halske.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to start building up the laboratory in Peenemünde,
mm-hmm.
what later became then the control laboratory.
Mm-hmm. So when you because I had interviewed Dr. Fritz Miller for a long period time in November, so you were assigned in the same unit that he was working in, I assume.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And working on the looking at how the platforms that were built for A5, I assume.
Right.
At that the state of.
Yeah.
But SG-52 and SG-6.
Yes, and at that time there was already some idea about the SG-66.
Mm-hmm. So that the...
Which was later then the secondary platform for, or the only real stabilized platform for the V-2.
Mm-hmm. Right. So at the, when you, this would be sort of December 39 through to March 40, mm-hmm. you had some kind of definition of what SG-66 would look like,
yes,
on paper only.
Not only this, but also mm-hmm. how to test the dynamics of the missile.
Mm-hmm.
See, at that time we had no idea yet how to control in a stable form one axis of a rocket. And mm-hmm. so we had to develop analog computers, and Geiselgeräte had the first analog kind of simulation of one axis
mm-hmm.
of the V2 or that time the A4.
Mm-hmm.
And this system then was, back, this method of simulation was then used first also in Peenemünde.
Mm-hmm. And this you experienced at Berlin-Zehlendorf factory, right?
Correct.
And that was, the simulation was a gyro being put on some kind of table, table,
something
like
that. And a rate gyro.
Mm-hmm.
For position, you needed a positioning gyro.
Mm-hmm.
And for the angular rate to damp or to have a stable mm-hmm. behavior, you had to have a rate gyro.
Mm-hmm. So you would have the the position gyro and the rate gyro on a table that was tilt table that was being moved
about one axis,
and the control signals being sent to produced by those gyros being sent to equipment which you could
to let's say electronic amplifiers, and from there to the servo motor that showed then the reaction on the simulator and caused a damping of the motion if you had given a disturbance.
Was the damping pretty successful at that point?
Oh, yes.
So that that
the only thing was it was not very accurate, and this required large tolerances, therefore in stability, because we could not have yet at that time high performance of the simulation, and this was the first step to go in Peenemünde to improve the analog simulation, reducing friction in the device and so on.
And improving, I suppose, a servo motor response, which
same
was
way.
Slow. I
we
mean,
had, we had a lot of problems with the time constant of the servo motors and even the servo motor control.
So, although the although you would damp the motion, successfully damp the motion of the table, with a, I assume that you had a number of oscillations about the until you receive that damping, so that the reaction time is slow and there's errors that have to be eliminated. So you went back to And let me first ask you a question about the Siemens and Halske system. At that point, I'm not entirely clear on just when they came into consideration. I guess it's sometime in 38, but that would be too far before your time to have known.
I could not give you any reliable information on that. I only know that they were involved, but at that time I did not see for any simulation equipment to test the equipment of Siemens Halske. And that's where we started in Peenemünde then. We tested their equipment in Peenemünde.
So you felt that they didn't have the capability to test their own simulation even on one axis?
Well, there was a group simulation method. We had the whole rocket suspended in one axis.
This seems to have pulled off. Get the wires so it's not stretched hot.
One method to test before the Labrador was established was to suspend the rocket in about the center of gravity and have it movable about one axis, the axis to be controlled. And then we had springs attached to simulate the aerodynamic forces, the restoring forces, and to give the system its own frequency, natural frequency. And then the control was exercised through the jet vanes on the burning rocket. And a deflection, an initial deflection of the vanes caused a disturbance to a signal, and then the system had to move back into its desired or zero position in a dynamically stable way. And this was the only method when I came to Peenemünde, which was used to test the dynamic behavior of the control system.
And that would have been
using was very expensive, of course, and cumbersome, because each time you had to have the engine operating.
And that would have been done with an A5, right? Because the A4 wouldn't have existed even until 1941.
It was all done on the A5.
So you would have these simulations, and you did not at that time have in the laboratory, at least because you were building a laboratory, had not had even what Kreisel Geräte had in terms of a tilt table. So you were then brought back to build up that portion of the guidance and control laboratory. So your first task then in early 40 at BSM under Steinhoff was building up this capability of simulation.
Correct.
In one axis.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And so did you have to hire new people to do that, or
actually,
did you organize the resources?
Several people worked on this.
Mm-hmm.
I reported to Mr. Shea, mm-hmm. who
How was the name spelled for the transcript?
S-C-H-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
Or E-E-R. I'm not too sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was S-C-H-E-R. And mm-hmm. he did not come to the States after the war. Mm-hmm. And he went to one of the museums in Darmstadt afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And he reported actually to Dr. Steinhoff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, working in this group were several people. Helmut Hölzer, mm-hmm. as you probably know already, had always had the idea it is easier to get the angular rate from the attitude information by differentiating this. And so he had been working on this. Mm-hmm. And this was one of the schemes we tested out on the analog simulation equipment
mm-hmm.
in the laboratory.
Mm-hmm. I know
of course, we had several engineers. Mm-hmm. For instance, we had mm-hmm. Mechanical engineers and designers who mm-hmm. worked on the equipment itself.
Yeah.
Mr. Joseph Böhm
yeah.
was quite involved in this.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that Dr. Hölzer, as he later became Dr. Hölzer anyway, was working on the guide beam or light stroll in early 40. Was he at that point, or was he at that point doing this also as well on the side, or is this after he finished with the guide beam work, I think?
At that time, you had heard probably also the name of Dr. Steuding.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Steuding was the one who mathematically was involved in the dynamics of attitude control and guide beam.
Mm-hmm.
Stability. And so we developed at that time also in the laboratory another system or another analog simulator mm-hmm. that showed you how the missile moved back into the guide beam when it mm-hmm. was through a disturbance like from wind or so put mm-hmm. outside the mm-hmm. center of the beam. Mm-hmm. And this was another equipment which I had designed at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And where then Dr. Hölzer, who looked into how the beam could be generated, how the signal could be received for guidance,
mm-hmm.
He gave us this information, and we then simulated the behavior of the missile with respect to the guide beam.
Mm-hmm. And this is a simulation carried out completely in electronic form, right?
As opposed it was almost mechanical again.
Oh, was
you
it?
You had again a second order differential equation, mm-hmm. which you use to move a mass. In this case, on the guide beam, it was a rotating mass.
Mm-hmm.
And that simulated then and was constrained and controlled by a motor.
Mm-hmm. So you had the rotating mass as a kind of, as a simulation.
Yes.
Of I'm trying to imagine this because I guess my technical training is not up to it. The rotating mass simulated the
mass of the system,
mm-hmm.
of course, in a translational motion
yeah.
towards the center of the beam. But mm-hmm. the mathematical equations are basically the same. You have a second order equation,
mm-hmm.
and whether you simulate this by rotating or by an actual transverse motion, mm-hmm. that doesn't matter. A transverse motion was almost impossible to be used in this case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we used mm-hmm. the rotating principle.
And the correction, the equivalent of the correction for lateral dispersion was the rate of rotation?
The distance from the mm-hmm. from the center of the beam.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now,
and of course, you had to have mm-hmm. some damping effect, again,
mm-hmm.
By generating a derivative of the signal.
Mm-hmm. Now, so you So did the simulation of which you developed of attitude control, you know, in one axis, evolve from that simulation of lateral deviation from the guide beam?
We kept these two as two separate analog systems.
Mm-hmm.
One for attitude control,
mm-hmm,
and one for beam control.
Mm-hmm. What I meant by evolved, did the equipment evolve from the simulator for lateral dispersion,
oh, yes,
or is it sort of, or was it parallel development?
No,
mm-hmm,
went, which used the equipment by checking it,
mm-hmm,
on the analog computer and,
mm-hmm,
improved both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
We refined the analog computers, and
mm-hmm,
then we could give better specifications again for the equipment, mm-hmm, that had to be used in actual flight.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I'm saying is, well, I'm sure they evolved simultaneously to some extent. Did one come first? Did the guide beam simulation come first? Or did you sort of do these two things more or less,
well,
in parallel?
You had first
all the time
idea how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You had an idea how to build the equipment.
Right.
And then immediately you ask yourself, how can I test it?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in case of the guide beam, you had first made some airplane flights,
mm-hmm,
to measure the signal when the airplane deviated from,
right,
the center of the beam.
Mm-hmm.
And this gave us first the signal strength, with which then we derived, from which we derived mathematically the equations,
mm-hmm,
and then we determined mathematically what the missile should do,
mm-hmm,
what the gain factors would be, and then we tested it on the analog equipment.
Mm-hmm. So that you had something to go on.
Right.
I
should
go
bring
ahead.
One additional, mm-hmm, point in. All these simulations,
mm-hmm,
like attitude control and control with respect to the flight path, of course, were only time-frozen simulations,
mm-hmm,
not considering the varying coefficients of the equations.
Mm-hmm.
See, when you have a higher speed, then your constraint, your aerodynamic constraint is different, your mass is different because you have used up fuel,
right,
and all this changes your gain factors and,
mm-hmm,
for the control system. So you had to consider all these viewpoints, and we could do it only step by step,
mm-hmm,
by making a test, for instance, a takeoff, shortly after takeoff,
mm-hmm,
on the simulation equipment, in the 10s, in the 20s, in the 50th second, and so on.
Mm-hmm. By a series of steps that
all
you,
right,
could get an approximation.
Not continuously change the coefficient at that time.
Mm-hmm. This might get me out of chronological order, but did you solve that problem later with the development of the simulators and of the Holzer's analog computer?
It was never used. What
mm-hmm,
the equipment could have done in Peenemünde,
mm-hmm,
it made these changes, and later here in the States.
Mm-hmm.
But I had then, later in Darmstadt, I continued to work in Darmstadt for Peenemünde beginning 1st of May, 1942.
Mm-hmm.
And there I developed an analog computer for attitude control, which would have permitted,
mm-hmm,
this continuous change.
Mm-hmm.
But by that time the specifications were frozen already for the V2, so nobody wanted to use it anymore.
Yeah. Everyone was too busy running around trying,
yeah,
to get the thing to,
yeah,
into
I
production.
I had, by the way, described, mm-hmm, all this in a report.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you had seen this.
I don't know if I had. Which one is? Is that the report in one of the specialist, or?
I have a copy here.
Okay, so can you remember approximately when? In 1940 or 41, you finished was it in 1940 that you finished the simulators and started using the simulators for attitude control in one axis?
There was a continuous development and improvement.
Mm-hmm.
They,
mm-hmm,
were conceived in 40, but the development continued,
mm-hmm,
practically throughout the time.
Mm-hmm.
Franz von Wasserfall, another pendulum type, purely mechanical, had to be developed, which I developed also in Darmstadt. Mm-hmm. And this one was had the features to avoid time constants, which were still permissive in the V2 control system, mm-hmm. or in the V2 analog computer.
Mm-hmm. So from 40 to 42, while you were still physically located at Peenemünde, that was your main task,
correct.
Was it?
Correct.
And was involved in simulating the performance of the competing gyro systems.
Yes.
And
improving simulators as well as the mm-hmm. mainly there was a problem, how to reduce the time constants mm-hmm. in the control system.
Okay, by reducing, let me see if I can translate that into more non-technical language. You mean reduce the faster response time,
yes.
So within the system. So you were constantly striving to improve the time constants for A4 systems, both the Zeeman system and Kreisel-Goreta.
Yes.
And I know that also sometime in there, and I'm not exactly sure when right now, the Ascania Mola system came into play, and then I know even less about Anschütz.
Yes, I got familiar somewhat when I started in Peenemünde, but very soon mm-hmm. these schemes were abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was already in 1940 that they were mm-hmm. Put aside because the other two systems mm-hmm. were more promising.
So when you returned to Peenemünde in March 1940, Anschütz and Ascania were already possibilities that were being investigated? That is, they were already
At that time, Ascania was only Siemens Halske was at that time involved.
Mm-hmm.
And Ascania was practically followed up mm-hmm. as a backup in case one of the other systems, mm-hmm. the primary systems, would not work.
Mm-hmm. I know that I've just seen titles of archive reports that indicate that there were A5 launches with Ascania guidance in 40 or maybe into 41, but I'm not really sure because I haven't exactly checked how many there were.
Do
of
you
which
mean in this case Ascania as a Siemens system?
Ascania, it appears from the titles of these archive reports that there were A5 launches with Kreisel-Goreta mm-hmm. platform
yeah.
with the Zeeman system, which I guess
yes.
is not a platform because it's rocket fixed.
Right.
And it appears with a Scania or Müller.
No, that's what I do not recall.
Mm-hmm.
I've been at most of these launches,
mm-hmm.
and I do not recall that there was one with a Scania.
Mm-hmm. I'd have to check in to make sure that was true mm-hmm. by looking at the reports themselves. But your impression was that a Scania fell out of the running fairly quickly.
Yes.
What specific difficulties or what problems or inferiorities in terms of accuracy and so forth do you recall?
I think there are people, now that is surely my guess, there are people did not investigate to a satisfactory degree the dynamic behavior mm-hmm. of a rocket
mm-hmm.
and did not use simulation equipment as we did. And so they used only these very expensive tests on the test stand where the missile was suspended
mm-hmm.
on one axis. And this was just too cumbersome to make a sufficient number of tests in a short time to check out the system.
Mm-hmm.
And their theoretical background was, in my opinion, not satisfactory.
Mm-hmm. And Anschütz name comes up, I get the impression they were involved even less, or it was even more briefly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They offered you a gyro system as a possibility?
I could not say I was not enough involved in that.
Mm-hmm. So an anecdote that Helmut Holzer told me, which I need possibly more information about, is that he was telling me that all of the systems as they existed were not, did not produce stability, in part because they were depended on a mechanical or hydraulic transmission of the forces to the control vanes, right? Or the signals,
well,
the correct...
I think we flew several systems which were well stabilized with right gyros, like the Siemens system, and also the method of Geiselgräder. And we had good stable flights.
On A5s, you mean?
On A5, correct. But it was not an elegant solution. We had very often, because of vibrations and resonances, difficulties. And so we, especially Helmut Holzer, promoted the use of electronic differentiation to obtain the rate from the altitude signal. And he succeeded with this. And then, of course, we tested this first also in the laboratory and then in actual flight.
In A5?
Right.
Did you, you did simulate this with A5s where you took out the rate gyros and did it that way. See, what he told me was that at some point there was a A4 simulations where they had built A4 control systems and using a whole rocket suspended in gimbals, that they had attempted to demonstrate the competing control systems without using the electronic differentiation. And that those systems were not inherently stable, as opposed to using the Mishkaret or whatever.
Well, mainly the stability problem at that time was with the method to suspend the missile. You had huge friction. And so even if you had some results of stability on your test stand, it was not guaranteed you had the same results in flight because the simulation was too poor.
Okay, so you were working on these competing systems. I guess another question I had about the competition between differing guidance and control systems was why did the Zeeman system become the standard system? Because you know, Kreiselgräder had the advantage that they'd been there from the beginning and had built the system for A3, which had its problems, and then had built a three-axis stabilized platforms for A5 and so forth. But the Zeeman system, I guess because it's simpler, I don't know if that's what it
I
became
would call
the standard,
it also
first standard
because
system.
Because you did not need the gimbal, the large gimbal arrangement, and it was easier and faster to be developed time-wise. And we had always a tremendous time pressure. And so, as far as I recall, this was the reason why the Siemens system was given first priority.
When you say given first priority, was that
I think this came
resources?
Automatically because... No, resource-wise, I think they were treated easily. It's the same way in priority. But the decision was then made to use the Siemens because they just had earlier results in production.
And basically, we only had two gyros to produce.
Right.
No servo loops for...
Not the complex servo loops as needed for the system
platform. And it could be produced faster. So that... From what you're saying, it sounds like sometime maybe in 1940, latest in 41, it was clear that Anschutz-Escania had been eliminated, that Siemens was going to be the primary system for A4, and that Kreiselgräder was going to develop a platform that was going to take longer.
I think time-wise, the competition between Siemens and Geiselgräde went much longer. Beyond the time I had been in Peenemünde. I left Peenemünde, as I said, on the 1st of May, 42. And at that time, both were still in clear competition.
So that Siemens was still trying to improve its system as a competitor. You considered them, in a sense, competitors. That they were were fighting to for a long-term improved system over the initial basic system that was done for A4. Okay, let me just stop and turn over the tape.